Hey there, we're going to be diving into the Gospel of Mark in a few weeks, but there are a few bits of housework that I want to get taken care of first. Some concepts that I want to lay down to make it easier to understand the second gospel. The first concept I want to cover is the very misunderstood character trait of zeal. And in order to explore it, we're going to have to talk about Phineas, David, Abigail, Daniel, and of course, Yeshua, or you might call him Jesus. Each one of these men, and the one woman, were very zealous. But their zeal shows up in different ways. Phineas, of course, was forced to show his zeal through a desperate act of violence in order to save the lives of a multitude. David showed his zeal through both courageous acts of daring, but also through restraint. Daniel was zealous, shockingly enough, through surprising acts of mercy. Abigail was zealous and saved many lives through wisdom and gentleness. Now, Yeshua embodied all forms of zeal. Even though when people look at his ministry, they tend to confine his zeal to one particular event in the temple. Now, to be fair, I could also include Elijah's bold preaching, but we'll be talking about that in later lessons, so I don't really want to talk about that here. Isaiah and the greater Exodus he preached, was also very much one of the templates, for the Gospel of Mark. And we're going to be covering that too in later weeks. The greater Exodus is a huge thematic element of the Gospel of Mark, and actually of all the synoptic Gospels, but Mark just flat out doesn't even try to hide it. It's right there. I'm Tyler Dawn Rosenquist, and welcome to Character and Context, where I teach the historical and ancient sociological context of Scripture with an eye to developing the character of Messiah. If you prefer written material, I have 5 years' worth of blog at theancientbridge.com, as well as my 6 books available on Amazon, including a 4-volume curriculum series dedicated to teaching scriptural context in a way that even kids can understand it. It's called Context for Kids. And I have 2 video channels on YouTube with free Bible teachings for both adults and kids. You can find the links for those on my website. Past broadcasts of this program can also be found at characterandcontext.podbean.com. Back to it. There are so many zealous men and women in Scripture. It was hard to choose, you know, just a few. But it is an unfortunate fact that most people tend to associate zeal with violence or kind of being a jerk in God's name. See that on the internet, right? Now, zeal absolutely can be violent in our modern world, as we see in the Islamic Jihad, but it can also be relatively peaceful. Look at Gandhi. Look at Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in the arena of civil rights, both of them. And, you know, one of my personal modern heroes, Dr. King's niece, Alveda Celeste King, who has courageously championed unborn rights since the 1980s when she went through a major conversion in her life from being very pro-choice and very liberal to being very, very much for the rights of the unborn. But today I want to talk about biblical accounts of zeal and how different zeal can look from one person to another, depending on their calling, their maturity, and the direness of the situation. Because we are going to see a case of severe immaturity in what we're going to talk about today. Now, we'll be starting with the most dire situation with Phineas, the son of Aaron, the high priest in the camp in the wilderness. So let's read a bit from Numbers 25 out of the Tree of Life version. This is a messianic translation, really the only messianic translation that I really, really like. There's another one that's okay, and there's a whole bunch that are awful. I like this one because it doesn't just substitute words here and there or pop in Paleo Hebrew or whatever. It's actually a legitimate and very responsible scholarly translation by some really serious scholars. even down to reflecting the proper Greek verb tenses, which few Bibles actually do, because it just makes you crazy to look at it. If you are a member of the grammar police, which I am, but I just don't make a point of talking about it very often. I notice things. I just don't say anything about it unless someone's being mean. Then I think they're fair game. All right, so Numbers 25, starting in verse 1. While Israel was staying at Shittim, the people began to have immoral sexual relations with women from Moab. They invited the people to the sacrifices of their gods so that people were eating and bowing down to their gods. When Israel became bound to Baal of Peor, the anger of Adonai grew hot against Israel. And this uses Adonai instead of the Lord, just so you know. Adonai said to Moses, "Seize all the ringleaders and hang them before Adonai facing the sun, so that Adonai's fierce anger may be turned away from Israel." So Moses said to the judges of Israel, "Each of you, kill your men who have been joining themselves to Baal of Peor. Then behold, a man from Bnei Israel means the sons of Israel, came and brought a Midianite woman to his brothers before the eyes of Moses and before the whole assembly of Bnei Israel, while they were weeping at the entrance of the tent of meeting, because they had just been told to kill their own tribes people who were out committing idolatry and adultery." Now, verse 7. When Phinehas, son of Eleazar, son of Aaron the Cohen, saw it, he arose from the midst of the assembly, took a spear in his hand, and went after the man of Israel into the tent and pierced him through, both the Israelite man and the woman's belly. Then the plague among Bnei Israel was stopped. However, 24,000 were dead because of the plague. What plague? God had released a plague into the camp because of this wanton act of rebellion and idolatry. Then Adonai spoke to Moses, saying, "Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, son of Aaron the Cohen," Cohen means priest, "has turned away my anger from Bnei Israel because he was very zealous for me among them, so that I did not put an end to Bnei Israel, to all the sons of Israel, in my zeal. So now say, see, I am making with him a covenant of shalom, a covenant of peace. It will be for him and his descendants after him a covenant of an everlasting priesthood, because he was zealous for his God and atoned for Bnei Israel." Covenant of an everlasting priesthood. Covenants aren't ever broken from God's side. He gave them an everlasting covenant of priesthood. They still have it. So the sons of Phinehas still have a covenant of everlasting priesthood. It's been narrowed down through the sons of Zadok. That's for another lesson. Now, we see here that Phinehas, in his zeal, was responding to a dire situation. There was a plague in the camp. It had killed 24,000 people because some guys wanted to go over to the neighboring camp of the Moabites, eat their sacrificial meat, have sex with their women, and bind themselves to another god sexually. That's cult prostitution right there. And so God calls out the ringleaders. You know, they had committed a massive and abominable act of wanton idolatry, literally worshiping another god with knowledge and through forbidden sexual relations. I mean, when these guys decided to go big, they went big. Right in God's face with his cloud / flame over the tabernacle and everything. Well, they were already commanded to be slaughtered and hung facing the sun, which means that they were not only hung outside the camp, but with their faces away from God as a symbol of God absolutely rejecting them and the acknowledgement that they had actually absolutely turned their backs on God. But then, bold as you like, in comes Zimri, son of Salu, a prince of the tribe of Simeon, meeting one of the leaders. With his new girlfriend in tow, I like to imagine him pointing at her and winking and giving the weeping Moses and Aaron a thumbs up in defiance as he brings her into his tent south of the tabernacle. And probably with front row view because he was a leader and then, of course, he got busy. Can you imagine their jaw draws? Here they are with tears running down their faces, weeping, and people are dropping dead all around. This was nothing short of willful, disobedient sin right in God's face, right in everyone's face. This isn't the, I'm really ashamed of what I'm doing, but I'm allowing myself to be overcome by lust after I was stupid enough to go over there in the first place and I feel guilty. This is contempt. Very few people, when they sin, sin with an abject contempt for God. A lot of folks just, you know, they don't know any better. Or they've been taught that evil is good and that good is evil. Or they're overcome by temptation. We've all been overcome by temptation. Even if it was just that cookie that our mom told us we couldn't have. And we took it anyway. Not that I ever did anything like that. My mom's probably listening. No, not me, Mom. I was a good girl. No, she knows better. But, you know, not this guy. There was a plague in the camp because of this idolatry. And he's hooking up with a front row view of the southern tent wall of the tabernacle. Seriously, this guy does deserve death. No question about it. No question about it. And he needs to die because he's a prince. He's a leader. If he will do something like this within a stone's throw of the Shekinah, the presence of God, then what would he lead people to do when they get their inheritance in the land and they no longer have a visual reminder of God's presence? This guy who had been fed manna every day went and ate from another god's feast table. It's beyond disgusting. You've probably never even tried sinning this badly even before you were a believer. You couldn't because the conditions, it's just, wow. So Phinehas, the son of Aaron, he sees the plague progressing. Thousands of God's people are dying, 24,000 to be exact. And he went right into that tent with a spear and shish kebabbed both of them in the act. He was on top of her. They weren't pretending, not having a joke at God's expense. They weren't in there talking. He wasn't trying to convert her. They were straight up having sexual relations. And Phinehas speared Zimri right through the back, and the spear went right through her belly as well. Plague over. Zimri over. Pagan woman over. Everyone is over. Now, God recognized the zeal of Phinehas in saving the lives of his people by making a special covenant with him, covenant of peace, giving his descendants an everlasting priesthood. Now, Phinehas wasn't just a violent guy with a surly temper. He was a guy who used violence when there was no alternative, and lives were being lost all around him. And he was only violent to the actual person who was in God's face. This wasn't a casual sort of violence masquerading as zeal like we see with ISIS or the Muslim Brotherhood or whatever. He actually reminds me of Sergeant Alvin York, a World War I conscientious objector who killed in response to seeing people being mowed down all around him. If you haven't seen the Gary Cooper movie, see the Gary Cooper movie. It's a Gary Cooper movie, and it's wonderful. It's wonderful. Alvin York was zealous for God too. Zealous people don't necessarily enjoy killing, but they do it when it must be done. We see the people were around the tent weeping. They were very upset that they were given this command to kill their own people. I mean, that's something that we see over and over again in the scriptures and in Judaism today. They're very, very conscientious about each other's lives. very serious. When they slaughtered the tribe of Benjamin in Judges, and only 600 men were left. Was it 600 men were left? I can't remember. But even though they had it coming and they'd done horrible things, they were weeping that they'd had to do it. Okay, so like I said, zealous people don't enjoy killing, but they do what must be done. Now, our next example is David, and I'm going to show good zeal from him as well as bad fake zeal with him. I guess it wasn't fake. It was real zeal. It was just bad zeal. Now, good zeal with David. Obviously, David and Goliath. He was infuriated that Goliath was slandering God. How about the fact that even when David was on the run from Saul, he quietly and consistently risked his own life to fight the enemies of Israel, thanklessly? How about zeal that shows up in trusting God to take King Saul out of the way in his own time and refusing to kill him not once, but twice? Excuse me. Now that's a true zeal for God's kingdom, shown in not taking matters into one's own hands. You know, perhaps David's zeal shows up best, however, in his dancing vigorously before the Ark of the Covenant as it finally enters Jerusalem, not caring what he looks like, not caring what everyone thinks, just, you know, dancing his heart out. Now, what did David do that might have looked like good zealousness to him at the time, but wasn't? Well, his encounter with Nabal, who refused to feed David's men at the time of shearing, despite David and his men having protected his shepherds for free. Nabal dishonors David. I mean, he did. He slandered him pretty bad. Who is this David? You know, what is... Who? What? What? He refuses to give him anything. Now, when David hears about it, he rashly vows that not one man from Nabal's household will be alive by morning. Now, this wasn't zeal on David's part, because when David was zealous, it resulted in God's honor and the deliverance of God's people, just like Phinehas. This was personal offense all the way. Yes, he had an absolute right to be offended. Absolutely. And especially in terms of ancient honor-shame societies, they didn't have any little sayings like sticks or stones may break my bones, but names will never hurt me. No, you call someone names, you're risking clan warfare. I'm serious. You just didn't do it. But Nabal knew darn well who David was, even though he says, who's this David? He was the king's own son-in-law. Slayer of Goliath, champion of Israel. Saul has killed his thousands and David his 10,000s. Everyone knew who David was. And, you know, at the time, at the shearing, it's a time of celebration of wealth in the provision of wool on your animals from God. David wasn't asking a poor man for a handout, but instead a wealthy man. And he backhanded David as though he was nothing. David's ego was badly bruised, and he was responding with a violence that had nothing to do with his normal patient and wise zeal for God to work out his own justice in his own time. But I gotta say that he didn't follow this up later with the same kind of things, because when he was on the run out of Jerusalem from Absalom, and... I cannot remember the name of the descendant of Saul, or the relative of Saul who came out and was throwing dirt at him and insults and everything. And But David didn't take revenge on him when he came back into Jerusalem. He let Solomon do it for him. But I mean, he lost a lot of his rashness. Now, who was zealous in this story, though? In the story of David and Nabal. Well, Nabal's wife Abigail, she went out to face a wrathful army of 400 dishonored, hungry, angry men. So let's Let's read this. When Abigail saw David, she quickly dismounted from her donkey, fell before David on her face, and bowed down to the ground. As she fell at his feet, she pleaded, only me, my lord, be the punishment. But please let your maidservant speak in your ears and listen to the words of your maidservant. Boy, does she sound like Esther or what? I love her. She's my favorite woman in the Bible. Please, my lord, pay no attention to this worthless fellow, Nabal, for as his name is, so is he. Nabal is his name, and disgraceful folly is with him. But I, your maidservant, did not see the young men of my lord whom you sent. So now, as Adonai lives, and your soul lives, since Adonai has restrained you from shedding blood, and from avenging yourself with your own hand, now therefore let your enemies and those who are seeking to harm my lord be as Nabal. Fools. Now let this blessing, which your maidservant has brought to my lord, be given to the young men who are accompanying my lord. Please forgive the trespass of your maidservant, for Adonai will surely make an enduring house for my lord, because my lord is fighting the battles of Adonai. So let no wrongdoing be found in you all your days. If anyone rises to pursue you and seek your life, then let my lord's life be bound up in the bundle of the living with Adonai your God, but let the soul of your enemies be hurled away as from the hollow of a sling. So when Adonai has fulfilled for my lord all the good things that he has spoken concerning you and has appointed you ruler over Israel, then this will not be a stumbling block for you, or offense of heart to my lord, or needless bloodshed by my lord avenging himself. So when Adonai has dealt graciously with my lord, then remember your handmaid. Right there, she says, I should have seen the men you sent, and I should have taken care of it. I should have done something about it. It's my fault. Do you know what she also did? She said, David, you're wrong. She did. That's gutsy. That is gutsy. She said, so let no wrongdoing be found in you all of your days. She couched it, and she put blame on both sides on herself. You know, after having brought them an amazing gift of dressed sheep and fig cakes and raisin cakes and all that, she brought them a feast. But she also said, David, you're wrong. This isn't who you are. This isn't the kind of zeal that you are known for. This isn't who you want to be known as when you are king. We all know Saul's been hunting you. Everyone knows it, and we all know that you're going to be king. We all know why he's hunting you. You're going to be king. Nabal knows it too. He's just an idiot. But David, if you do this, you're going to be wrong. I mean, the courage that this takes. You know, we Esther is famously zealous and courageous. We see that when she goes before her husband. You know, when she knows that if he doesn't extend the scepter to her, she'll die, and he hasn't summoned her to himself in a month, and he's already called more harem girls because he's going to get another wife. That was zeal for her people, obviously. But Abigail, she went to him, well, probably very possibly to save the lives of her sons, but to save the lives of hired men who she, you know, in theory, you know, she's a great woman of a great house. She gets to say, they're just servants, whatever. He says he's going to kill the men, whatever. You know, he's not going to kill me. Me and my ladies, we're going to have plenty of money when he's gone. No. Her zeal led her to rebuke the next king of Israel. It's just stunning. It's stunning, but she did it in such a wise way. And so, you know, when it's a good lesson. How do you use zeal to rebuke? Study Abigail. Study her. She knows how to do it right. And the fruit of what she did just absolutely speaks for itself. David withdrew his hand and didn't slaughter the men of her household. I'll be right back. Hi, this is Tyler Dawn Rosenquist, and welcome back to Character in Context. This week we are talking about zealousness, and we're talking about the zealous. We've already talked about Phineas and David and Abigail, and we're going to be also talking about Daniel and, of course, Yeshua. You may call him Jesus in your home. But we're going to finish up the story with David and Abigail right here because it's really fascinating. Abigail showed such zeal in her wisdom. She put herself at the mercy of an angry army for the sake of the men in her household, including a husband who she clearly was not fond of. She appealed to David's forgotten zeal, the zeal that had previously led him to seek the Lord, not only seek the Lord, but to wait on his timing and to wait for God to vindicate him. Abigail's zeal reminded David of his own. Zeal doesn't have to be violent. It can be directed at allaying violence that would be harmful to the kingdom. Kingdom zeal is always for the best of the kingdom. It has to be a wise zeal, or it's not. It's just worldly. Now, what about Daniel? He and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were all zealous for God's laws, refusing to eat defiled foods in Babylon, and we all remember how the latter three refused to bow before the golden statue of Nebuchadnezzar. And we remember Daniel in Lion's Den, because he refused to follow the prohibition against praying to anyone but Darius for a whole month. Those are the obvious cases of zeal, but how about a less obvious but far more stunning case of zeal? Let's look at Daniel 2. This is often overlooked as zealous, but it's going to harken back to Abigail and ahead to Yeshua. Daniel 2, starting in verse 1. In the second year of his reign, Nebuchadnezzar dreamed dreams. His spirit was troubled, and sleep escaped him. So the king issued an order to summon the magicians, astrologers, sorcerers, and Chaldeans in order to explain to the king his dreams. When they came and stood before the king, he said to them, "I have dreamed a dream, and my spirit is anxious to understand the dream." Then the Chaldeans spoke to the king in Aramaic, "May the king live forever. Tell your servants the dream, and we will declare the interpretation." Sounds like some people on Facebook. The king answered the Chaldeans, saying, "I firmly decree, if you do not make the dream and its meaning known to me, you will be torn limb from limb and your house is reduced to rubble. But if you tell me the dream and its meaning, you will receive from me gifts and rewards and great honor. So tell me the dream and its meaning." I would have just died at this point. I'm not lying. That's awful. Now they responded a second time, saying, "Let the king tell his servants the dream, and we'll declare the interpretation." You can hear the desperation in their voices when you're reading it, right? Now the king replied, saying, "I know for sure that you're just trying to buy time. Since you see, I have firmly decreed that if you do not reveal the dream to me, there is only one verdict for you. You have conspired to say something false and fraudulent until such a time as things might change. So then, tell me the dream, and I will know that you can tell me its meaning." The Chaldeans answered the king, saying, "There is no man on earth who can meet the king's demand." I mean, at this point, we're all thinking, geez, at least Pharaoh told Joseph his dreams. "For no great king, however great or mighty, has ever asked for such a thing from any magician, astrologer, or Chaldean. What the king asks is too difficult. There is no one who could declare to the king except the gods whose dwelling is not with mortals." Well, because of this, the king was furiously angry and gave orders to execute all the wise men of Babylon. So the decree went out that the wise men were to be slaughtered. They also sought Daniel and his companions to execute them. Then Daniel spoke with tact and discretion to Arioch. I hope everybody on social media heard those two words. Daniel spoke with tact and discretion to Arioch, who was captain of the king's guard and who had set out to execute the wise men of Babylon. He spoke up and said to Arioch, the king's captain, Why is the king's decree so urgent? Then Arioch informed Daniel about the matter. So Daniel went in and asked the king to grant him time so that he might disclose the interpretation to the king. Then Daniel went to his house and informed his friends Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, a.k.a. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, or Rakshak and Beni, about the matter, so they would request mercy from the God of heaven concerning this mystery, so that Daniel and his friends would not perish along with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. During the night, the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a vision. And I'm going to skip the prayer here, Daniel's prayer of thanks. Then Daniel went to Arioch, whom the king had appointed to destroy the wise men of Babylon, and said to him, "Do not destroy the wise men of Babylon. Bring me in before the king, and I will declare the interpretation to the king." Okay. So, we all know the interpretation of the dream, you know. Common story. So what did Daniel's zeal lead him to do? It led him to save the lives of a bunch of magicians and astrologers. Did you ever catch that part before? He could very easily have made it so he, and only he and his friends, would remain standing to advise the king after the dust settled. But no, Daniel's zeal was full of mercy. I mean, he could have said, "Get rid of these charlatans. They couldn't do it, but I can. I'll be your advisor." You know. And I can't even begin to tell you how many believers I have met over the years who would consider themselves duty-bound to have all those pagan advisors slaughtered and wouldn't have lost a moment's sleep over it. But Daniel, who kept God's laws when it was dangerous to do so, he spared showing the pagan, or he spared their lives. He made sure that their lives would be spared. That's a stunning display of zeal for God's character, showing the pagan king how merciful the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob is. Certainly the pagan priest would probably not have been as eager to do the same if the positions were reversed. You know who else had that wrong kind of zeal? The disciples. They had a zeal for the kingdom, they had a zeal for a kingdom that would look the way that they thought it should look. Peter rebuked Yeshua when Yeshua said he was going to Jerusalem to be killed. James and John's just lovely expression of zeal included slaughtering a whole town full of Samaritans for daring to disagree with them. Because, you know, they were going to go spend the feast in Jerusalem instead of on Mount Gerizim. You know, that also reminds me of the misplaced zeal of Jonah in the face of Nineveh's repentance. You know, he wanted them to be killed anyway. The disciples became really angry when someone who, quote-unquote, wasn't one of them was casting out demons in their master's name. I'm going to read a passage from a very excellent book, The Victory According to Mark by Mark Horn, based on the on Yeshua's explanation of the parable of the sower, a.k.a. excuse me, the parable of the four soils found in Mark 4, 16 through 17. Here is Mark 16 through 17 here. These are the ones sown on rocky ground. When they hear the word, immediately they receive it with joy. And they have no root in themselves, but last only a short while. When trouble or persecution comes because of the word, immediately they fall away. Horn points out that the rocky soil very much describes the disciples before the cross. Here's his quote. When Jesus was seized, one of his followers attacked the mob with his sword and only succeeded in cutting the ear off the high priest's servant. That's in Mark 14, 47. Jesus' parable actually addresses this sort of hot-headed zeal. When he said, "And other seed fell to the ground, to the rocky ground, where it did not have much soil, and immediately it sprang up because it had no depth of soil." The same condition of the soil, which causes it to wither under persecution, is also the reason why there is such a sudden and visible response to the message of the kingdom. Why is persecution associated with this group? Because they seek out trouble. In summary of what Horn is saying, they are immature, so they seek out trouble, and then they fall away. That's exactly what happened to the disciples that terrible night of Yeshua's arrest. They, well, all but one, went look as he was gone. He looked for trouble earlier in the night when he sold his master. So they went looking for a fight, and they found one, and it didn't go well. And their master rebuked them, and then they all got... And he got hauled off. And instead of dying with him, as they all assured him they would, they took off running. This is why an appearance of zeal, while impressive, is not the same as a person living with endurance and faithfulness. Now, this has all been leading up to talking about the surprising zeal of Yeshua. Now, when people think of his zeal, they think of the one, two, according to John, instances of overturning tables and the cattle drive he conducted off the Temple Mount. Or they might think of the Matthew 23 rebuke of the scribes and Pharisees that I did a long teaching series on earlier this year. But truth be told, everything Yeshua ever did was out of zeal. From his resisting temptation in the wilderness, to healing the daughter of the Syrophoenician woman, to battling against demons, and which we're going to see a lot of that in Mark, to the healing of the crippled and ill on the Sabbath, and finally to the cross. Everything he ever did was zealous, including and especially his acts of mercy. Yeshua's zeal led him to dine with tax collectors and other sinners, putting himself in the crosshairs of the religious elites in a time when who you dined with was who you were being accepting of. And I don't mean accepting of their sin, but accepting of people. Okay? His zeal led him to call a tax collector, a Roman collaborating social outcast, as a disciple. He delivered people from the power of demons, sickness, and disability whenever it was necessary, regardless of what day it was. He suffered extreme hunger and thirst, exposed to the elements and wild animals in the desert, while enduring temptation without ever once giving in to the adversary's taunts and dares and temptations, which were quite insulting. He washed the feet of a man who would betray him. In fact, he taught and treated Judas like everyone else for the duration of their ministry together. He butted heads with the religious elites because it needed to be done, without constantly complaining about how picked on he was. He elevated the downtrodden and demanded mercy, justice, and equity as a qualification for those who would follow him. Means they weren't allowed to oppress anyone either. We're not allowed to oppress anyone either. He healed lepers. He raised the dead. Tossed out demons, and then often asked the recipients of his miracles not to go around telling everyone. He preached in places where they rejected him. He worshipped in the temple whose leadership rejected him. He even went outside the boundaries of Israel to Tyre and Sidon and to the Decapolis and to Gasp, Samaria. He spoke with a woman alone. Unthinkable. A Samaritan woman, even worse. A Samaritan woman who was shacking up. Somebody give my smelling salts. His zealous love for the Father and for his people led him silently, through a mock trial and to an unimaginably horrible death, when he could have called down legions of angels to his defense and to kill every one of his accusers and oppressors. That he didn't lift a finger. It's one of the reasons, one of the many reasons, actually, I could never accept Joseph Smith of the Mormons as a prophet. The man died with a gun in his hand. He was a violent man. Violent to save his own life, to save his own skin. And you don't see any of the prophets doing that. None of the prophets in the Bible died with a weapon in their hand. A lot of them were slaughtered. They died zealous for God, for God's ways. None of them died with a weapon in their hand. Doesn't mean that sometimes they didn't use it, but they weren't fighting for themselves. They were fighting for God. You know, Yeshua was more controversial than we can imagine, but everything in his life and ministry was the result of appropriate zeal, loving zeal. It's wrong for us to see all zeal as manifesting itself in some outburst. You know, then it wouldn't be zeal. It would just be a lack of self-control. Yeshua was either always zealous or he lost control sometimes and got in people's faces. No. When we look at the list of virtues of Paul's writings, we must always see them as related to zeal and not separate. Humility and meekness are at the heart of true zeal. We must know our place with respect to God and others, or our zeal will go very wrong. One of the themes we will be seeing throughout Mark is the messianic secret, where Yeshua was not fully revealing himself to anyone, with good reason. And we can't imagine the humility that that would take. Just look at the people in the world now claiming to be the Messiah. Are any of them humble at all? No. And they're oftentimes using their claim to desire to messiahship in order to gather harems around them and always to control others, to get others to die for them. They're not willing to die for others. What about this incident with the overturning of tables? You know, there are memes out there that make him look out of control. I think they're blasphemous. But the temple authorities were always looking for a cause against him. If he was out of control, if he was using that whip on people instead of as a way to herd livestock off the mount, wouldn't they have sent a contingent of guards with the full blessing of the gathered pilgrims? Yeshua would not have risked shedding blood in sacred space. That would defile it. We must not allow artwork that is often ignorant of Jewish laws regulating behavior on the Temple Mount to determine our understanding of what happened there. Yeshua was fully in control of himself. His zeal never got away from him or out of hand. Notice that at his trial, they didn't bring that incident up at all. They could have had him outright killed if what he had done atop the Temple Mount was against, instead of enforcing Jewish law, as opposed to Torah laws, that a lot of the stuff that was illegal on the Temple Mount, you just couldn't legislate against it in the Torah because they had a small tent area. You don't mess with sacred space or go nuts in it. Everything had to be very much on the up and up. I mean, after he went through the whole incident, he was teaching people. People sat down, and he sat down and people listened to him teach about how they weren't allowed to carry burdens on the Temple Mount. You know. So evidently, they weren't adverse to hearing him teach after that. It's so important to know the historical context and really question how much we accept from medieval and Renaissance painters and modern meme makers who often have an agenda of zeal being whatever bad behavior they want to justify today. You know, maybe Maybe it's just me, but I don't think that you automatically have the right or calling to overturn tables unless you're willing to die for the people sitting at them. Wash the feet of people betraying you, and be silent. Silent in the face of persecution. As I get older and gain much-needed perspective, the overturning of tables looks far less zealous to me than the cross, than washing Judas's feet, and calmly enduring a mock trial. And, you know, you could say, but, overturning tables is the only thing that I want to do on that list. Well, exactly. If we want to do it, it's not zeal. It's nothing but playtime masquerading as righteousness. You know, there's this meme out there, and I hate it. I hate it. And it's one of those Renaissance paintings of Yeshua overturning the tables. You know, everybody's dressed in, like, you know, Renaissance garb, you know? except for Yeshua. He's always wearing robes, and everybody else is, like, dressed like modern people a lot of the times. I can't remember if that's one of the cases. I think it is in that painting. They're all wearing modern clothes. He's wearing robes. But they say, when you are asking yourself, WWJD, what would Jesus do? Just remember that flipping tables is an option. Or flipping tables and whipping people is an option. Something like that. Yeah, it's an option. But how come so many people make it their go-to method of communication? In all of his time in ministry, in all of the terrible things he saw, with all of the oppression, with all of the stuff that the high priest and his cronies, the Sadducees, were doing. They were Roman collaborators. They were oppressing people. They were getting rich at the expense of people who were losing their land, their houses. They were starving to death. He was walking in the midst of oppression that we in the West really can't even begin to imagine. He could have overturned tables every day. But he didn't. He did it once, or maybe twice, unless John was just being midrashic and repeating the same thing in order to make bookends. That's a Jewish thing to do in ancient writings. But he did it one time, you know, maybe twice, and only in the temple, and only because they were violating it on a very profound level. Not because somebody disagreed with him. You know, he didn't overturn tables because someone disagreed. He didn't overturn tables because he didn't like one of their doctrines. You know, if he didn't like something that they were teaching, he just taught the other way or did something another way. He healed a pagan woman or centurion servant or he did good. And yet we define his zeal by one or two acts. And that's very self-centered. That's selfish. That's self-serving. That's we wanting to behave in a certain way. We wanting to lose our cool. We wanting to yell at people. We wanting to not wait until something rises to the actual level of defiling the temple and the worship experience that was going on in the Passover season when there were pilgrims from all around the world and they were in the court of the Gentiles and maybe the Gentiles even had to strain to hear the Levitical singing. I don't know. And so, yeah, the Sadducees had turned it into a den of thieves and Yeshua started flipping tables to fulfill a prophecy saying, "Zeal for your house has consumed me." But what's our excuse? And how little provocation does it require for us to feel like we need to go flipping tables? And are we really just fooling ourselves that we like to be destructive and we like to be insulting and because we're immature? I mean, that's always been my thing. Anyway, it's just something to think about and see you again next week when, I don't know what we're going to talk about. We'll see when we get there. Bye-bye.